To start with, could you tell us maybe a bit about the history of the band prior to the Pretty Hate Machine?
There really wasn't one. I mean, it kind of started with me. I was living in Cleveland, Ohio, and working at a studio basically so I can get some free time and fuck around. That just led to working on some demos that started to take shape and sort of have some sort of identity. And I turned that, I did that for about 10 months or so, to where there's about 6 songs done that were of the state I would send them out to somebody and say, what do you, you know? And we got some interest from Network originally, and Sub Rosa. And we just approached like little independent labels to see if, my philosophy was, I'm not really sure exactly, I don't have Nine Inch Nails figured out yet at this stage. If I have a situation where someone can give me a few $1,000 to do a 12 inch and nurture it. And Network, we were going to do a deal with Network and everything was set up, and then they came back and said, we ran out of money, can you wait for another 6 months, because we spent all our money on a Front 242 record. And that's what led to, they then called and said, you know, Skinny Puppy was on tour, it was a Vivisect album at that time. And said, do you want to open for Skinny Puppy? No, because we would like to, but we don't have a band together. You know, it was basically me and Chris at this time. And then when Skinny Puppy came through town, their tour manager looked me up and said, look, the bands we have on tour suck. Just go out with us. And they were also trying to throw us bones. Network was to keep us in line. So we ended up playing like 8 shows with them up the East Coast, and we fucking sucked, terrible. I mean, there's no, we were awful. Because it was at a stage where the music I had listened to and my kind of influences were fairly conservative because of where I grew up. It's very little input, and literally it's a farm in the middle of nowhere. And there wasn't any such thing as college radio or any sort of media. MTV wasn't out yet, not that that would have helped. But so classic rock radio, and you know, your options of cool things to listen to were Queen or Kiss, you know, that kind of shit. You know, and I'm not embarrassed to say that, but that's shifted. It was just a weird situation where none of the stuff I'd ever done, I'd ever tried to play out, and a lot of it was a lot lighter, and I realized that a lot of the arrangements of the songs were really off base, and it was a bit poppier. And we got off that tour humbled. But another label had seen us and offered us a deal, which was TVT out of New York, which sucks. Technically, they don't have any distribution through anybody else. They claim they do their own, but they're by no means what I would call a major label.
Okay.
Maisie, sit down. So we ended up signing a deal with them, and then we ran into our first big problem, which was the record that I delivered them was not the record that they expected to get. And trying to, you know, I'm playing tapes of stuff Adrian Sherwood has done to convince them, look, let me use him, you know. My manager just called up On You Records and just said, look, we don't have that much money and we're on a label you've never heard of, but would you be into doing like a remix or working on some stuff? And send me a tape, sent him a tape, and then said, yeah, I'd be into doing it. So that's how we contacted all those people. And it was same thing with Flood, he's a great guy. Yeah, but when I came back and said, here's my finished record, then they took a shit on me. And they said, this thing sucks, you know, radio's not gonna play it. Because they expected it to be a Fine Young Cannibals record or something. And it wasn't at the time as radio friendly as they had hoped it would be. And they had no, it was just a bad scene. So that started the trouble. And then when it came out in America, nobody, you know, radio wouldn't play it. So we just started touring and kept touring and kept touring. And then suddenly someone pointed the finger at us and said, here's a band that's cool to like. And then we get on that weird kind of thing. You know, the people that initially liked us, the fanzine crowd, the Wax Trax kind of fans, started to feel a bit alienated because the same record they liked when it came out, a year later, their kid sister liked. So there was a bit that all that what could be a 5-year career got condensed into one record worth of time. And the last time we had toured over here was Lollapalooza, which is 2 years ago, the first one. I think the weird thing in America right now, and I don't know what it's like in Europe so much, or England or wherever, but MTV is so powerful now that they pretty much determine what bands are going to get big or not. And I mean, as an artist that, I mean, we make pop music, essentially, or it's music that is to a certain degree accessible. You have to be aware of the pitfalls of playing into that too much, you know?
About that period of time, people started to compare you to Depeche Mode. How did you feel about that?
Well, I went through a period where I felt really shitty because I felt like first couple tours were playing clubs in front of people that would be the me as a fan, you know what I mean? People I could relate to a certain degree. And then as the popularity got bigger, the people that mean more to you are the first to jump off the bandwagon. And then, you know what I mean, the masses. That's a real shitty feeling, to be quite honest with you. Then I think you go through kind of the Nirvana syndrome, which was my broken record. Okay, I'll make a record that's not trying to be commercial or pop or any other fucking thing. And then I fucking win a Grammy for that. You know, and I don't know how I got a Grammy for best hard rock band or something. You know, it's like, and then you realize that I'm just trying to make the music that I enjoy making, and I can't say, you're cool enough, you can like it, you're not cool, you can't like it. And just make the best of it and do what you think is fair. You know? Nirvana made a record that was as unaccessible as they could make it to show, look, we're punk rock. No, you're not. You know, you write pop songs, and there's nothing wrong with that, you know? I'm trying to make the best shit I can make. I'm not trying to make something that I think caters exactly to what radio is playing right now. We never did. If they bent to like us, fine. If they didn't, I don't give a shit. But I don't feel like I've ever put out something that I've whored myself to do just to be commercial pop singer, you know? Well, in terms of Depeche Mode, I think some of the stuff they've done is good. I'm not a big fan of what they've just done. I just saw their show. Because oddly enough, I've become friends with their singer, just because he lives in LA. And he's a misfit like I am here. And I like the guy, I mean, but their show is like a Bon Jovi show. It's just, you know, crotch grabbing and screaming girl. It's personally not what I'm into at all. I don't. But I think part of it's probably because they use synthesizers and they write pop songs, you know? So, how many bands do that, really?
I think Broken was a much harder record. Why was this?
Well, at the time, we were now leaving TVT because that had gotten so terrible that the situation had become so unproductive to where if I were to, say, want to do a video, anything from doing a video to a print ad in a magazine would be weeks of just discussions. Who do you want to use to do your video? I want to use Peter Christopherson. Well, I don't think you should use him. Well, I think you should use the guy that did this Ice-T video. Well, I don't use him. I want to use Peter. And then every other thing is okay except the one I want. So then I have to play, okay, I want to use Peter, so I'm going to say, okay. You know, that kind of, I mean, but that gets drug out into. And then there's things like finding out by accident that they're going to re-release your first 12-inch with a new cover. Why? To fool everybody that's expecting a new record, to buying that and discovering, oh, it's the same record, but who's going to be the person that gets blamed for that? Me, you know? Someone's going to say, I just put 10 more bucks on this thing, it's the same fucking, those kind of things. And when Pretty Hate Machine started to really sell, I thought maybe they would realize they were wrong. Just leave me alone, I'll make a record. But it became, no, Pretty Hate Machine sold 1 million records, well, your next one's going to sell 5 million because we're going to make sure you have good radio song. I mean, seriously, you know, someone came in and said, I'm going to be doing all your editorial work for you, and I've got a great cover coming up. It's got RuPaul's on the cover because we need to sell some issues. We've got to get you into the bigger markets. You know, it's like, that's a fucking horrifying feeling, and you have no control over it. So Interscope came in and bought us out of the deal. And Broken had come out, we recorded it kind of, we had to go under a different band name and just do it off in the middle of nowhere. because technically any music we would have recorded, TVT still owned. And I just told TVT, fuck you, my career's over because I'm not making another record for you guys. Mm-hmm. It's not about money, it's just about, let me do what I, you know, just. And in terms of money, we'd sold a million records. I'd never gotten paid anything. Where did the money go, you know? And they're lying to us. Oh, you sold about 200,000 records, and yeah, that's a real fucked up situation there. I mean, the basic thing with TVT, and the guy that runs it is the frustrated artist type who, I don't know why he's in the record business other than to boss people around, or maybe think he's gonna get laid by being it. And he does not have a fucking artistic bone in his body.
Most bands seem to start off with quite a hard edge, and as they get more successful and commercial, they get softer. Nine Snails seem to have done it the opposite way.
Well, I think it's been a situation of touring so much, things got harder. And then just, it's been kind of a natural evolution. I never sat down and said, I want to make everything harder and harder. But at the same time, I'm also aware of the new record that's getting finished now is not, it's bleak. It's got elements of the hardest stuff I've ever done, but it's not like a Ministry record. You know? To be honest with you, I kind of divorced myself from thinking too much about what, I think that is what it is, and people that are going to get it, and if politically a writer has to say it sucks because it's this, and it's, I don't give a shit, you know, it's like I did what I wanted to do, and the people I care about will get it. Yeah. Well, a note on that is, just to officially say once again, never have I sat down and said, I'm an industrial band. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And the people that bring that up, or where that came from, is American writers who, for lack of any better knowledge, around the time Pretty Hate Machine came out, Wax Trax was a much more prominent. So you had Ministry and the rash of bands at that time, from KMFDM to Nanskin Puppy Odyssey. That got tagged onto. That I see that as no more appropriate for them than us. So then, the next fucking thing that always happens. Okay, so, let's imagine you work for Spin, and you've never even heard a synthesizer in your life other than a Kraftwerk record that you've had. And now, suddenly, Nine Inch Nails is on Lollapalooza, and you've never covered them before. And, okay, Ice-T's the rap band, Living Color is the black band, okay? Nine Inch Nails, they're the industrial band. What does that mean? You know, and then I get tagged all the time. And I find myself, most of America has no idea what the fuck industrial is or was. So their idea of it now is me. Tag me for all those people. And then all the people that are music fans would know that. It irritated. Okay. Here's what I think industrial music was, okay? Educating Throbbing Gristle, blah, 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 can, perhaps. Do I think we have much in common with them? No. Is there a use of noise? Yeah, okay, that's about where it ends, you know? I try to write songs. I know that Throbbing Gristle doesn't, you know, and I don't think that's bad that they don't, you know? At the same time, I think what's happened is if they needed to have a term, which all journalists seem to have some sort of way to place you in what you are. What are you? I got a British guy yelling at me about, well, what are you? Are you an electronic band? So I realize that, and that's another thing, as we emerge from kind of being an underground to more mainstream, that's been one. I know it's irritated a lot of folks in terms of that. And I've never sat down and said, hey, we're the newest thing. We're an industrial band. It's an irritant, but I can't get away from it, so I've just learned to just ignore it. And, you know, people that know, I think, are tired of that same, I hate fucking Nine Inch Nails because they're not fucking monsters anymore. I know we aren't. Did I ever say we were, you know? I appreciate those bands, you know? I have listened to them. I wouldn't say they're the biggest influences I've ever had, but...
But...
You know, it's just a thing that needs to be... I mean, I hear that Prong is industrial. You know, they're a guitar band. It's from that to Machines of Loving Grace. You know.
Could you tell us what was the idea behind Fixed?
well, again, in America, the idea of the 12-inch remix is kind of evaporated now that everything's on CD instead of vinyl. And I just wanted to, the original idea was to just farm it out to a bunch of different people that I respected and say, do whatever you want to do. I don't care if there's not one note of the original song in there. And then just put together an assembly that was very kind of off the cuff, less thought went into it. It was more random, more indulgent, which I think that definitely is. Some of it's hit and miss. There's leftover snippets of stuff that was around. And sell it as a 12-inch, you know, as one 12-inch would encompass all the songs off the record. And some of them didn't come to life, and some of the ideas I had were kind of shitty and didn't work as well. Like, Coils was awesome, I thought. Yeah, that was fucking great.
What about the Butchvig track that we've heard about?
What's on there is a tiny little bit of a remix he did. And the idea was kind of like, here's how the chain of thought went. Towards the end of that thing, I thought, you know, what if I could get like Pantera to redo a song? Or just somebody really from another world that's super heavy. And then I realized that wasn't going to happen at the time allotted. And at the same day, I got a fax from Butch Vig saying, I'd like to work on something that you've done, or are you into doing anything with me? And I don't just do Nirvana bands, but I did a EMF remix or some fucking thing like that. I would be impressed by that. So I called him up and talked to him. He's a really nice guy. He's from the same general area of the country that I'm from, which breeds the same kind of mentality somewhat. And I said, you want to do a remix? Yeah. What do you want me to do? I just said, make it the hardest thing you've ever listened to. So I sent him a track off the record, and called me up in a couple days and said, you know, I've had a lot of fun with this, but I listened to the tracks, and there's no way I could make it harder than it was. So I tried a totally different direction, and I hope you'll like it. You may not like it, though. So I got the DAT back, and I put it in, and it had been... The song was last, and it was, he had turned it into everything I fucking hate. It's a jangly guitar kind of thing, and played all the instruments on it, and I really appreciated the amount of work that went into it, you know, and the craft behind it, but I just hated it. I mean, I hate it much. I can't listen to my version of the song anymore. Nice. I just can't, ugh. And I thought, you know, keeping in line with what the idea of the record was, I should put it on there, because that truly is do whatever you want to do. But I realized if I did that, college radio is going to start playing it.
Right.
I can just imagine a horrified fan grabbing and like, what? Is that Nine Inch Nails? Oh, Jesus. Remember, we got to be industrial, and I can't have any jangly guitars going in there. So, put me in an odd position, because I appreciate what he did, and I didn't mean to talk shit about him. I don't think I have, but that, I wasn't ready for that at all. Fetus One, I mean, that's the thing where Jim and I are kind of friends, and I just said, go to town. 2 days later, I did that, and that was it. And I think it's cool for what it is. I realized when I sent him the tapes, I didn't realize until I got the DAT back, that when we did that song in the studio, I'd had Martin Atkins, of all people, playing drums on it. But then we added program drums and then kind of cut between the two. But the program drums weren't on tape, so he didn't have them. The Fetus didn't have them. So the only drums he had to work with were Martin's, which instantly gave it a whole different sound because it's real playing. And, no, I liked him. I'd like to work with him in some capacity. And, well, what we're trying to do right now is, I met Peter through, how am I saying? Just through being a fan of Coil, generally, but also realizing his videos that he's done, I really liked a lot. In particular, like, the Tainted Love stuff, and it's fucking cool. Especially, I saw it maybe four or five years ago, and it was particularly chilling. And, so we'd made, after we got free from TBT, because I didn't even want to enter him into that melee of confusion, for Broken, we tried to do, original idea was to try to find people that had never done videos before and give some new guys a chance, and also for our own benefit so that videos didn't look like standard issue. We hired that guy who just did REMs and just did blah, blah, blah. And that started a long and painful search of art schools and stuff, just looking for someone that you're trying to read in. Does this person have their shit together enough to actually see it get done? And is it interesting content enough? And we really had a hard time finding stuff, surprisingly. Maybe we went around about the wrong avenues, but the one guy I ended up using, I'm just completely drawing a blank for some reason right now. Who worked with all the survival research, John Reese. Seemed like a cool guy. Have you ever seen his my brain just stopped on me. He did a film outside the survival research stuff, which is pretty cool. And I talked to him and he had a pretty cool, he was psyched because this just fell out of the sky onto his lap. You know, you want to make a film for $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, you know. Yeah. And we talked, I had an idea, talked to him about it, and we spent about a month just refining the idea into, I think we accomplished maybe 70% of it by filming it, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's the basic idea that I had, but turned into a thing of, okay, obviously this is unplayable in most circuits. Yeah, so let's just make something that interests us, and then we'll see what we'll do with it at the end. And, you know, it got done, and I'm tired of seeing it now. The first time we did it, it wasn't really extreme enough. I mean, it's already beyond the line of what's going to be played on TV. Okay, so why then just stop it? You know, just fucking go for it, you know? And the guy that's in it is so extreme to start with that just what he does normally, filmed, is real intense stuff. And so we finished that. We did one for Pinion, the intro to Broken, which is only a minute long with no vocals, which is the only video we gave, the first video we gave to MTV. So it's a world premiere video. And I don't know if you've seen that or not. That was a guy from New York did that. And it's pretty interesting, but it doesn't matter. If there was an issue of censorship that it got taken off because of something. And then I talked to Peter, and for Wish, we wanted a more basic, kind of somewhat performance-oriented video. And it was just totally cool working with him. Yeah. He was a nice guy. And we got along fairly well, and there came a point afterwards where I wanted to I started working on this album. I thought, no one's seen most of these videos, so how can I put something out that where people could see it that's not just, here's our three videos and something backstage footage of us? So a week later, he comes back with this idea that was awesome, but extreme. And it also incorporated doing another video for the song Gave Up on Broken. Now the theme was elements of, have you seen Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer?
No.
There's elements of that in there, where someone, your point of view is the handheld camera of the abductors. You're riding around LA and you see this kind of kid walking down the street. Next thing you know, that kid's tied up in a garage somewhere. There's a TV in the garage, and on the TV, you'll see the beginning of one of our videos, it zooms into the video. At the end of the video, it zooms out, and whatever was happening in that video starts getting done to the kid, and eventually leads to the last thing, which is the video for Gave Up, which is the most extreme thing I've ever seen in my entire life. We did this. We actually had the whole thing done. And when he showed up with the footage, because we edited it at my house, it was unbelievably real, and it made Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer look like a fucking Bambi movie. I mean, it is unquestionably frighteningly real and sick, because it was all like a couple generation videos, so it looked like whatever might have been fake got made. Yeah, it looked like a snuff film. It looked really bad. So we edit this thing together, and he's like, no, no, don't worry, we can edit this. Well, fuck it, let's just make it exciting to where we're like into it, and then let's see what happens. And so for about a week, we got this thing done, and we're watching it and everything. We put all the videos in it, and there was one instrumental, Help Me, I'm in Hell, we were going to do a thing for that we didn't get to yet. And so we're at the online place, finishing it up, and looking at each other like,
people there are just sick and they can't even watch it, you know, and there's like dismemberment to corpse fucking door to everything. And sick. We get done with it and he's like, look, let's just get away from it for a week. And we talk on the phone, and it's kind of like, okay. I don't even know where we'd start to edit it down because the content is what's so... It's not the scene of a dick getting cut off. It's not a scene of the heart getting ripped out of... You know, it's... So we thought, okay, if we release this, we got to put it out the way it is. And then the reality of... He was afraid because... of the laws in England, filming that kind of shit, I guess. I was reserved about the fact of, I did it because, I basically funded a film I thought was interesting to me. Yeah, but the idea of having to explain to 10,000 interviewers, I just wanted to make a cool film, you know, and trying to take the heat, and the record label would get all kinds of shit. They would try to put it out, and get banned here, and it's like, and the negative aspect of, oh, he's trying to just outdo himself. Let's just sit on it and see what happens, you know. But I don't know what we're going to do. I mean, I just kind of said, and he agreed, you know, I was like, it wouldn't make sense to edit it down. Uh-huh. And then the way it is, if it was a matter of, hey, there's one scene, it's 20 scenes here, and then fuck it. You're still going to get the idea of what it's about, which that's the most offensive thing, you know. But it was fun to make, and, you know, it was my pocketbook, so...